Hey everyone, it's Carolyn back with you. I have Tish with me here. Thanks for coming back and doing another one, Tish. This week that people are hearing this podcast, they're working their way through part three, a taxonomy of vulnerability. So last week they read chapter six about angels and a crowded cosmos. And they read chapter seven about tending the sick and having bodies now and forever. And then this week, they're going to read chapter eight, give rest to the weary, weakness and silence, and chapter nine, blessing the dying. So maybe I can ask you some questions about those chapters. Here's my first one. I wanted to ask you about insomnia. Do you ever in the book write about the medical condition of insomnia?
Yeah, I say something like, there are some who have the medical issue of insomnia. And so I'm not talking to the folks, I'm talking to everybody else. I have some friends who, one friend in particular, who her whole life story has been shaped by a deep struggle with insomnia. And I know different folks have struggled with that through seasons of their life, and some people struggle with that more than others. So yeah, I bring it up briefly, but I don't talk like deeply about it.
Do you think that you would, is there a place for a both and approach? Like, so I'm in midlife and I will sometimes use sleepies over the counter preparation to help me fall asleep. But I would want to combine that with prayer and other healthy practices. Do you have room for that?
Oh, no. I'm all for medical treatment for conditions.
Sorry, didn't mean to turn this into a personal therapy session, but I'm just assuming there's other people out there like me who it's hard to fall asleep. So there are over-the-counter things you can take to help you fall asleep, but they work much better in tandem with say prayer than doom scrolling. So just curious about how you think about those categories.
Yeah, I think that's fine. I'm probably not very equipped to even talk to that about that. I'll say, like, I think it needs to be both and, right? I think it's good to go and find if there's deeper reasons that we have difficult sleeping. But yeah, it's kind of like depression, right? I mean, I think depression, this is not the same as insomnia, but depression points to often things we need to grieve, things we need to deal with. I think it would be a very bad idea for folks who struggle with, and I say this as someone who has struggled with depression, to like just go get a pill for it, right? Like mm-hmm. when we struggle with depression, I think we need to think about exercising, ways to take care of our body, definitely go into grief and emotional help and get a counselor. But also as part of that, certainly like medication can be very helpful. I don't think it's not a silver bullet. And there's actually evidence that I'm going to get this wrong, but I think it's like, it only is helpful to like 30% low dose. I'm talking low dose. I'm not talking extreme depression here, but that it's unhelpful as much as it is helpful. But I've had friends I've had family members whose life has been deeply changed positively by antidepressants. So I think it's great. I would just say, let's be holistic and like use it while also doing things like exercise, community counseling. So I guess I would say the same about insomnia, to figure out deeper reasons that we're wrestling with this. But we're not Gnostics, right? Like our bodies, the reason that we wrestle with some of this stuff is because we're embodied beings and our bodies are broken. And so if there's ways to help that through medicine, that's a gift.
Yeah. And other practices too, probably, like not having caffeine past four. And, you know, like, you're right. It's the whole, you've already made the case for us being embodied.
If you ever ask me, is it this or both? I'm like 97% of the time going to say the answer is both.
which is a really appropriate conversation for this crowded cosmos chapter. Like that there's always, we're always trying to solve things in 2D and they're always kind of happening in 3D is kind of what I got from that chapter. Have you read Ronald Rollheiser?
Yes.
He has a book called The Shattered Lantern. that this chapter really made me think of. The way that you talk about disenchantment in this chapter, he calls reducing our symbolic hedge. He says, like, we used to have a really high symbolic hedge. Now we have this really low symbolic hedge. He gives this example of a guy who has back pain. And he's like, okay, is this back pain a physical symbol? He needs to go see a doctor. Is it a psychological, emotional symbol? He's in midlife and he's starting to realize that he's breaking down. Is it a spiritual symbol? Is it an invitation to participate in the suffering of Christ? And he's like, yes, it's all of those things, you know? I think that's why I started thinking about physical causes for not being able to sleep in your chapter about a crowded cosmos, that there's just a lot going on. And yeah. So, and then I wanted to ask you, now that you're not embarrassed by angels anymore, do you have any sort of, doctrine about them or systematic way of thinking about them, or is it more just an acknowledgement that they're there?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's actually something I need to study more. I thought about that when I was writing this chapter. There's pastors, and particularly like in the Middle Ages, folks had these like whole cosmos, like they had an order of creation, they had angelology is like a thing where they like studied this. And I have not done any of that. It's not in seminary now. I think I made it all the way through seminary without talking about angels ever. Maybe we talked about demons, but not much. And I went to an evangelical seminary, so it wasn't like it's because, you know, they were liberal or didn't believe the scriptures or something. It's just, we didn't talk about it. So I actually need to study this more. And most of what I've read about it is sources that I read for this chapter. And I say this in this chapter, but man, like, people in church history talk about angels all the freaking time. It's shocking. So I think I'm really at the beginning of learning about angels. And the stuff that's out there now in evangelicalism is like, it's terrible, right? It's like fictional, like very like apocalyptic kind of angels just feel very, very far away from our ordinary life in that. Or like I say in the book, it's just this like sentimental trite. Like my mom collected angels, and so there were all these little this like cheesy books, evangelical books about angels, and one was like, you know, like, be an angel to your friends. I guess they were talking about being kind, but it was all about sort of like being like the angels, and there were pictures of angels, and it was just the worst. So all I know from scripture is that angels are terrifying, and that they're common, that they're around, and that they are messengers from God, and that they apparently, at one point at least, were capable of falling, like rebelling against God. So, and that we are made a little lower than the angels. So I feel like I'm still, I have a lot to learn about angels. That's what I'll say. And if your pastor went to the average evangelical seminary, they didn't teach them about angels.
More to come. Okay, let's go to chapter 8, give rest to the weary, weakness and silence.
My editor actually didn't even pick up on this, but if you look, every chapter has a different Christian practice in it. I don't want the walk away from this book being like, I got a pretty compliment, right? I want it to be like, oh, there's like all these different ways of prayer and all these different kinds of spiritual practices that we can walk into, you know, from silence to grief to, you know, lament to the experience of beauty, like seeking out beauty as part of prayer to, you know, I talk about in the chapter on joy, I talk about my daughter praying with a crayon and a pencil. So I was trying to put different ways of prayer out on the table for people. So silence is one. Yeah.
I just wondered if you had any specific coaching or things that have helped you to have silence be in some way prayer and not kind of a rogue time spent listening to your rogue thoughts march around in your head in the absence of distraction. Just coaching. I mean, Renovari is a huge advocate of time spent in silent prayer, but I confess I'm still such a junior at it. It works so much better for me to have at least to just pray silently with words. So when you're talking about silent prayer, are you talking about not saying things out loud, or are you talking about something different?
Well, that's a great question. I feel like a junior in all kinds of prayer. But I did a class for my church on silent prayer. So first of all, when you practice silent prayer, whether it's new or you feel like you're have done this 1,000 years, thoughts are going to come. Like that's just part of it. And that's okay. Sometimes God might even use some of those thoughts to kind of shape your heart or prayer when you go back into word prayer. But I think the best analogy I've heard from this is that it's like boats on a river. The river is your thoughts. These boats, your river is kind of your conscious mind. These boats are these thoughts that are going to come in. And your job in silent prayer is to just let them keep going. Like, don't stop. Don't try to jump on the boat. Don't be scared that the boat's coming. Don't freak out. Just let the boat keep going. So what I'm saying is you're going to have thoughts, but trying to kind of let them go and not then obsess on them or worry is really helpful. And in the same way, this is maybe an analogy, because I don't want it to be like we're emptying our mind in a kind of Eastern sense, because I'm not exactly sure that's totally what's happening. But it's like when I'm on a date with my husband and I'm sitting in his presence and maybe we're not even talking. If my cell phone rings, like I don't get it, right? I don't pick it up because that takes me out of that. I let it go and I just miss it, right? And so I think it's the same. I usually check and make sure it's not the babysitter and then I dismiss it. And so it's the same that when a thought comes, we're in the present, we're experiencing intimacy, the presence of Jesus. And so we just sort of let the thought go and continue to be with the one we're with, right? So the other thing I would say is that it is sometimes very helpful in silence to have something to meditate on. This can be an object like a candle or an icon, but it also can be a word prayer. And then just leave silence in the middle. So a great example is the Eastern prayer, the Jesus prayer, that Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Sometimes, actually, Scott Cairns is the person who he recommends this in one of his books, is to do that prayer, but instead of doing it quickly, so instead of saying, I'm going to do 100 Jesus prayers, say, Lord, and then live a long, long, long time for silence. Jesus. And then lead a long, long time for silence. So it's something that your mind sort of can sit with, but then you're intentionally placing silence through the prayers. Or you could say the whole prayer, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Or the Lord's Prayer, or the Gloria. Then have a long period of silence. Then say it again. Then have a long period of silence. So that there's something kind of grounding in it, but then you're intentionally having silence in between. Where you're just sort of listening for what comes up in your heart. A lot of times emotions will come up, sadness, anger, but you're listening for the Lord as well. And if God kind of lays something in your heart, but you're also just some sort of silent. The other thing about silent prayer is that you need to give your permission for it to be kind of boring. Like, because sometimes it's these deep experiences of God. And sometimes it's like, nothing is happening. I feel like if a couple months ago I went through this period where it was just this beautiful nearness, the sweetness of God when I would get silent. And then like this week, I actually was saying to God, like, what's up? Because it just feels like it's boring. Like I'm just literally sitting there. It doesn't feel particularly spiritual and it can feel like kind of a waste of time. And so I think that that's just, I want to say that's normal and it's okay. The other thing that's very helpful for me is to set a timer before I go into silent prayer, because otherwise I'll just think about the time and how long is this going and how long am I. So you know, just setting a timer for me sort of is like, okay, I like don't have to think about the time now and it's on its own. And then start real slow. And yeah, it's okay if it's not like a incredible spiritual experience. It's okay if it's just like, okay, I practiced being with the Lord and I practice not, you know, getting completely caught up and obsessed in my own thoughts. And just practicing that for a really short time is good in and of itself. Yeah.
That's great. It's really helpful. I skipped over my question that I wanted to ask you about chapter 7, the 10, the sick Lord Christ embodiment. You say in this chapter, one of the cases you make really strongly is that God lets nothing go to waste. which is a big theme for me too. Like that, this is one of the only promises we actually get is not no pain, but no wasted pain. Like there's nothing that he can't redeem and do something beautiful with. I always get a question when I talk about that. And now I have the chance to see if you can answer it, because I can't. And it is people who have severe mental illness in their family, particularly when that illness manifests as an inability to sense the presence of God. Because the other thing I say is our promise is that we can't go through anything alone. These are like my two big things. You can't go through anything alone, and there's nothing that God can't do something beautiful with. And people say, well, my child has had schizophrenia for 30 years, cannot sense the presence of God. How do you work with that? How do you think about that?
Well, I mean, that's a really hard question. So I don't have like a There's not an easy answer to that. And I'm not going to be able to give one. I'm not going to be able to be like, oh, you know, it's just, here's the answer. I don't know, you know, except possibly that, well, first of all, I would say, I want to say a few things. Number one, God is present with the afflicted. This is, I would include, I have a chapter on affliction. Whether they're aware of that or not, I think God is present with the afflicted. I mean, there's certainly folks that have deep cognitive issues. There's a kid in my church, you know, has profound autism. So, you know, what does he sense of the presence of God? Like, we may not know, right? Because he can't speak, but yet he's baptized. And so there's like grace was given to him that he, this is partly why this is not, I know, not trying to argue here for the baptism of infants, but there is something beautiful about the idea that, man, this isn't, we're not responding to something you cognitively got right. We're not responding to like something you believe. We're just giving grace when you can't even articulate whether or not you believe this, because folks that have profound mental illness or profound cognitive impairment aren't able to articulate things. And yet I believe Jesus, I mean, Dorothy Day talked about we serve, or maybe it was Mother Teresa, that we serve Jesus in all his disturbing, distressing disguises, right? And that Jesus is among the afflicted. So that's the first thing. Secondly, I would say something like, I talk about this the chapter of affliction on affliction would be a good response to this, because I talk in there about this kid who was born with profound genetic abnormalities. And so, you know, she lived till she was about 11 and died. This is Andy Crouch's niece, Angela. And he talks about like, what does flourishing look like for her? Like, what does that even mean? And he talks about, well, you can't just understand flourishing here as an individual thing, but that her life and the way she was cared for by the people around her led to a flourishing of a whole community. Like that she brought, in some sense, caring for this girl whose body was broken and who couldn't speak, and who knows what she experienced of the presence of God, that it brought a flourishing to the medical community around her, but also to her family and their friends and folks caring for her. That's not enough of an answer, but I do think, I don't know, except that Jesus is with those that are afflicted, and that in our caring for this, so in these folks caring for their son, did you say, who's schizophrenic, like they are encountering God through that, but also like they are embodying the love of Jesus by caring for those who are weak and are struggling. And so there's just this, there's a grace in the love that they're able to give to their son in the midst of this. The last thing, and I know that I'm like ducking out a lot of these questions by referring people to other books, but a great resource is, there's a book called Darkness Is My Only Companion, A Christian Response to Mental Illness, and it's by Catherine Green McCrate. She's an Episcopal priest, and she is something like bipolar. I don't want to like misdiagnose her, but has struggled very profoundly with mental illness. I mean, to the extent that it's been life altering for her and at times like unmanageable. And she talks about in that book what it meant for her to know God in the middle of that. So that would be, I think, a helpful, probably more helpful than my answer is to read that book.
Very helpful. Thank you. Okay. Well, the last chapter for this week that people are reading is the Bless the Dying chapter, which you've subtitled Ashes. And yeah, I had never even noticed that that's just right in there with the list. Like there's just this acknowledgement that some people, they're not going to make it and to bless them. Great, great chapter. I love how you hold the tension that we're not supposed to be okay with dying, but that we can still pray for a blessing of the dying. And that the prayer that asks for healing and checks on the will in the same breath. That's hilarious.
That was when I was like, I have to write this book because I love that so much.
It's amazing. Yeah. The pragmatic. And it does come down to what you said in the first podcast is, do you believe ultimately that death has been conquered? I mean, that's really the only way we work our way to a satisfying conclusion here. But I wanted to ask, I'm from an evangelical tradition and we have almost nothing for when someone is dying. And I didn't realize this until I was in hospice with my mom. And I just didn't know what to offer her or what to do. And people started sending me liturgies and they were lifelines. So I just was wondering, as an Anglican priest, do you have something like last rites? Do you have...
Yeah, we do.
Talk about that. Yeah.
We do. We don't call it last rites, but we do have, it is basically something like last rites. We have a liturgy that we walk through with folks that are dying or on their deathbed and final communion. And it's beautiful. It's a letting go. I honestly have never performed it, but my husband has. More than once, numerous times. I love it. I really do. It's something that I like about the tradition is we have the churching of the women, the blessing of mothers and babies after birth. So we have a liturgy for when you come into the world and we have a liturgy for when you're leaving it. And I really think all traditions should. I can't imagine. I can't imagine. What do you do? What do you do when you have a baby? When you just gave birth or when you're dying, if there's not like prayers from the church for that moment, the Eucharist is part of it because we're Anglicans. So we just do the Eucharist like constantly all the time. And that's a really good thing because what liminal space that is. Right. So yeah, we did COVID, like going back to a fourth circle, we started the last podcast talking about COVID. We great man in our church in Austin who's just so beloved named Bill. He was in his 90s and he passed away from COVID. And the sad thing is he was single his whole life, but he was deeply beloved in this congregation, in this church that we're part of in Austin and what are going back to be part of. And so he would have been surrounded, you know, by folks, and he wasn't able to be because he could see no one because it was still fairly the beginning of COVID. And so the rector there, Sean, our friend, did last rites, did pray a liturgy over him, a liturgy for the dying. He did it over Zoom and it was good that he could do that. But that's a hard part of COVID is that it isolates the dying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, speaks to the power that these prayers of the church can be. So I want to particularly urge my fellow, you know, folks who are in lower church traditions to make use, to borrow from these riches, because, yeah, I really experienced that when I was trying to help walk my mom over the line. So, yeah. Well, thank you for all of this. After this week, we have 2 weeks to go. And in the final of those 2 weeks, we're going to have you on for readers' questions. Anything you want them to be aware of as they go into the final portion of the book?
No, just read to the end. Liturgy of the Ordinary, my last book, I kind of made it where you could just kind of pick it up and start in each chapter. And I mean, it is probably best to read it like beginning to end, but each chapter kind of stands on its own. But in this book, I raise a lot of questions that I don't fully answer till later in the book. So at least read the last chapter on the love of God.
I don't think anyone's going to skip any chapter. It's too good. But yeah, make sure they get all the way to culmination, huh?
Yes, exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Great. Well, thank you. Thanks for the gift of your time and the gift of this book for working. It wasn't toil. It might have felt like toil, but it wasn't, because it wasn't futile.
Labor is not a thing. That's actually really good to hear.
Yeah.